listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, spending time on the back roads of Wisconsin, you might come across downtowns with vacant storefronts and old signage and barns and houses that have been left on their own. We'll talk to a photographer who spent the last 20 years documenting these parts of rural America through the lens of his camera. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of these interviews as they happened at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we wrap up the Democratic candidates for lieutenant governor. The winner of that primary will face the incumbent, Rebecca Clayfish, in November as part of the Democratic ticket. Kurt Kober is a business person whose past work was in retail strategy for the Clorox Company. He's also the co-founder of an industrial design startup. He's with us now at our studios in Madison. Kurt Kober, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks again for having me, Rob.
Well, what role do you see for an effective lieutenant governor?
Yeah, you know, the lieutenant governor of Wisconsin is a role that's largely shaped by the person that occupies it. And I have a very clear vision for the role to be very active. There are really two pieces I see it. One is acting and serving for the governor when they need my help on negotiating or working on a particular initiative. But I will come into this race and aim to, as lieutenant governor, work on really two major issues. One is being a public advocate for all of our public schools, K through 12, our technical colleges, and our UW system. And then secondly, really spearheading initiatives to help build a culture of entrepreneurship in our state. And we've had a good model of what this looks like when Barbara Lawton was our lieutenant governor. She had a very clear portfolio and measurement of that portfolio and was very successful in the role.
How do you see your background as someone in the business world helping you in your role as lieutenant governor?
Yeah, I always tell people I've had experience in nonprofits and in education and in business. And, you know, the thing that kind of connects all of those things is helping organizations transform to meet the needs of the new economy or a new vision for an organization. When I was at UW Green Bay, for example, for undergraduate, I led a student initiative along with a broader set of students to raise over $45 million to build new facilities on that campus, facilities you'll see there today. We had set a vision. We made it very clear what the first, second, and third steps were, and then engaged the broader community, the state legislature, and eventually the Joint Finance Committee. So that experience in education, nonprofits, and business is a diverse set of experiences that I want to bring to this role.
And you'd be coming from outside the world of politics. Do you see that as a pro, a con, a little of both?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of both. I think, you know, we are in a time where there's phenomenal change around us, and we need fresh ideas and fresh thinking about how to solve for those things. And so having someone come from outside the political system, but that's been very civically engaged in every community that I've ever lived in, I think is a good balance for this role.
Now, you're going to be, as if you win your primary, you'll be part of a ticket with TBD, one of eight possible candidates
right.
for governor. How do you see yourself working with as yet unknown candidate for governor?
Yeah, this is one of the things, as I, even before I started the campaign, started meeting with the candidates that were running for governor to talk about my vision for the office and understand what their vision is for the office. And so in those conversations with every one of those candidates, I think we've been very clear. They've been very clear with me, and I've been clear with them on what the role looks like, both in the campaign as well as after being elected.
Talking to Kurt Kober, a candidate running for lieutenant governor in the Democratic primary. Let's take a caller. We've got Steve on the line in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, yes. My question is we have a very divided state right now. In this age of Trump derangement syndrome, in a state that voted for Trump in the last election, what are you going to do to try to keep your party in line from a civil standpoint so that our state isn't as divided? It's very easy to point to the other side and blame others, but what are you going to do specifically to keep your own party in line to honor that flag to be civil to each other?
Steve, thanks for the call. Kurt?
Yeah, Steve, thank you again for that question. It's part of the reason why I'm running, honestly. As you stated earlier, I've come from outside the political system. Because as I was talking to Wisconsinites, you know, we've spent working on this for about a year, although we launched the campaign in January. And one of the things I did and a team of us did as we traveled the state is we just listened. We just asked questions and listened. And what we heard across our state was the common theme is people feel like we're not making investments to allow our communities to be places where every generation can live, work, and thrive, at least, you know, broadly across our state. And so one of the things I really am talking about in my campaign is we need to be zero focused on what it takes to build strong communities again, where every generation can live, work, and thrive. And that means we need to invest. And what that looks like can be different, right? And how we transform education, for example, to be seamless for students while, you know, respecting educators. You know, I think we have the opportunity to have a different conversation, and that's what I'm trying to do in my campaign.
One possible outcome in November is that we could end up with a Democratic governor and lieutenant governor and Republicans in control of one or both chambers of the state legislature. How do you see yourself in a situation like that, reaching across party lines to get stuff done?
Yeah, this is one thing that I'm passionate about. You know, the work of government doesn't stop because of divided government. If we have a Democrat in the executive branch and Republicans in the legislative, it's part of why I'm running for lieutenant governor, is because we can get work done in this office that doesn't require legislation. But there is opportunity, I believe, for legislation to be dealt with a Democratic governor and Republican assembly and state senate. As you look at high-speed internet, for example, in our state, I talk about this a lot on the campaign trail because, you know, there are too many people, almost 20% of Wisconsinites that don't have access to high-speed internet. And there are people, you know, here in Madison who are just paying too much and getting too little. And as I've talked to Democrats and Republicans in the state's Senate and Assembly, I've found that there's actually opportunity to come together and solve that issue. And I believe that there are a bunch of issues that we can work together on.
Now, looking ahead to a general election campaign, if you are the nominee, Governor Walker and Republicans can point to low unemployment numbers here in Wisconsin. They have a long list of what they can point to and say, hey, we've got good economic news. Why knock us out of office now?
Yeah, I think that what I've heard from voters all over the state is, you know, we have a low unemployment rate because we have a lot of people working a lot of jobs. It used to be you could have one job and pay the bills and take care of your family. Increasingly, we're seeing people taking two or three jobs to make ends meet. So, you know, the other side can have the conversation about what that unemployment rate looks like. But when you look at wages in our state, you know, they're pretty almost flat to what we saw back in 2010. And so that is, you know, felt by everyone in our state. And so that's why I always talk about we need to build a new economy in our state, one that produces better paying, meaningful work, not just a low unemployment rate.
Staying on the jobs theme, a lot of the Democratic candidates for governor have expressed concern about Foxconn and the incentive package, and I'm understating things there. Some of them want to cancel the deal. Some want to renegotiate it. What would you look for with Foxconn?
Yeah, with Foxconn, I believe it's a bad deal for Wisconsin taxpayers. It's a bad deal for us on a variety of fronts, environmentally and economically. And one of the things I will offer up to the governor is to lead negotiations with Foxconn to deal with the environmental issues around air and water and ground, as well as the economic issues. And how do we develop that supplier network for Foxconn to really make the project pay out? This wouldn't be my first time doing that kind of work. I've negotiated with companies much larger than Foxconn, and I'd be happy to take on that that challenge.
And as we start to wrap up, who or what inspired you to pursue a career, or at least this post, in public service?
Yeah, there's so many people. You know, one of my Wisconsin political heroes is Dave Obey. I think he was a champion for Wisconsinites when he was in the majority and was in the minority. He was focused on getting things done. And that's my orientation. You know, whether we're in the majority or the minority, we have to get things done for Wisconsinites. We've got to get creative on how we do that. So he's been an inspiration for me, but there are a variety of others too.
We'll leave it there for now. Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Kurt Kober, businessperson and Democratic candidate running for lieutenant governor in the primary campaign. Between now and the August 14th primary, WPR has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Tune in all next week at 4:30 and 6:30 to hear our conversations with the candidates for governor. We talk quite a bit about rural issues here on Central Time, things like the challenges facing Wisconsin farmers and rural population shifts as young people move either out of their small hometowns or back to mid-sized cities. Now we're approaching the topic from a different angle, behind the lens of a camera. Our guest has spent the last 23 years driving around back roads across the United States, Wisconsin included, to photograph and document what he calls the lost Americana of rural America. Vincent Johnson is a Chicago-based photojournalist, filmmaker, and the founder of the Lost Americana documentary project. Vincent, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be on.
Before we get into the images you're trying to capture, I want to talk about how you got into this. This started as a chance to take some cool photos, and it turned into a lot more for you. Take us through your story.
Somewhere back in 1995, and let me know if you're getting too much feedback here. I was just taking a photo class at a local junior college and ended up taking some photos of an old barn. I lived in an area of outside of Chicago in Joliet, Illinois, which is kind of right on that what used to be the rural and urban divide. And it was a 5-minute drive to get out into the farmland. I just started taking pictures of old barns. When I got into college and I actually went for photojournalism was my major, I ended up kind of documenting these things, these barns and these small towns. And the photographer in me was like, oh, wow, really cool old buildings. They look great, graphically. And then I think the journalist in me started kicking in later as I started driving further west past that rural divide. And what I thought was maybe just urban sprawl was the reason for some of these abandoned barns or barns that were like kind of left to fall over, turned into questions. Well, why is this main street empty? We're nowhere near a major city. There's no suburban area that's creeping in here. Like what's going on? What's the process that's making this happen? And it kind of led to this being more than just kind of a summer project for a color photography class. And it's, I just haven't given it up for 23 years now.
Now, when you say lost Americana, what kind of things are you looking for? What makes you tap the brakes and start pulling over to get that photograph?
I will tell you this. I would like to say it's the time of day and the perfect light, but for some reason, I tend to find the neatest places to shoot right around noon and the lighting is horrible. In general, I have a bit of an idea when I go out what I'm looking for or the area that I'm kind of looking for, and that's for the most part, Ben, I try to find the place that's got the fewest roads and the fewest major cities. The farther away from an urban area, the better. It's turned into a lot more where I just randomly drove. I would like pick a direction and drive to. Now I'll do a lot of research. I'll use census information. I'll read stories. I'll try to see what areas have been losing like vast amounts of population. And those are kind of ones where I pick. So a couple of years ago, I was in the Arkansas Delta region, which has been really hard hit down there. I mean, there's counties losing 20% of their population just in the last decade. You end up in just about anywhere in the western areas of, North Dakota, Kansas, and those counties are all, they're seeing major population declines around. And I mean, even places like out east, you get Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois seeing it as well. Wisconsin's got a few. Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, maybe not quite as bad as some of the other states out west, but it's happening in every state. And, one of the things that I always notice is I'll hear stories from local publications about a county that's a rural area that's losing stuff or, a state that's losing its population in the rural area. But it always seems to lack this overall encompassing thing that it's pretty much happening everywhere. And it has been for a while.
Yeah, on the journalism side of this, you started looking into this. What is happening? What's driving this decline in rural populations, rural farming, and the things that go along with that?
I think that, the big one is, and the obvious one is, it got a lot easier to farm, and farms got bigger. So you used to have a farm that was, maybe a town had 20 farms that surrounded it, and each one of those farms would take 10 to 15 people to work throughout the year. I mean, maybe not continually, but people who maybe worked at the grocery store were able to get supplemental income by working on those farms. And then as they got bigger, that was, it went down from like 20 farms to maybe 4, and you got better machinery, better, more efficient on your production side. And now I think the average farm is somewhere around 600 acres, which is kind of small when you end up in places like Kansas or Nebraska, but you got farms out east that kind of bring that number down. But there's farms that got like 3,000-4,000 acres, and there's maybe 1.5 to 2 farmers on average taking care of them. And the towns, they're no longer there. I mean, those towns sprung up along rail lines to help the farmers get their wares to market. And now the logistics and the efficiencies have all changed, And so those towns are kind of no longer serving a purpose, and they're struggling to kind of maintain. And then you've got a second wave that happened when somewhere around the 1990s, we went from, I think the 1950s, we averaged about close to 30 million farmers in the country. And by 1990, that was down to just under 3 million. And so now you have this wave of the people who were left in the 1990s were generally the people who were on the farms and taking care of the farms. But they also started to get older, and the efficiencies also let some of the farmers stay longer. So you have this double effect of everybody there is aging out, and the second generation that normally would have taken over didn't because the first generation was still on the farm. And that's just a generalization. There's definitely more minutia to it, but it, overall, that's probably one of the biggest arching things is you have an aging population that's out there still, and the farms are bigger and take less people to run now.
Now, that's a huge decline in the number of farmers, but you've written that this is kind of not invisible, but close to in some ways. If you lose 1,000 factory jobs after two plants close, people notice that. If you lose that same number of jobs distributed over a few counties over a decade or two, it doesn't hit you all at once.
Exactly. And I don't have the math exactly like what it would be by state. I mean, if you know one of the things, whenever you hear economic reports, they'll talk about the payroll report, and it'll always say non-farm jobs. And so you never hear how many farmers or how many farmhands were losing their jobs over these years. And if you were to break it down from that 31 million down to 3 million, it roughly comes out to about 12,000 farmers on average a year per state. And I mean, I guarantee you, Illinois and Wisconsin probably lost more than, say, like a Delaware or a Maryland that aren't that big, or an Alaska that doesn't have the, you know, the farming. So, you know, you could be looking at close to 20,000 people that were essentially out of a job, but spread out over a state the size of Illinois or Texas, it doesn't show up as much. It's just on an individual basis. Oh, it's just, you know, the millers that, you know, had to move out of town because their dad couldn't find work anymore, as opposed to, you know, everybody that worked at the mill in this town losing their job.
Talking to Vincent Johnson, photojournalist, about his Lost Americana documentary project. Vincent, you've traveled a lot in these communities. What kind of things do you hear from people? Do you hear a lot of stories of regret about their way of life?
No, I people love it out there. I was, you know, about a year or two ago, I was up in North Dakota, and I found myself in a field taking a picture of an old farmhouse that was in between two different farmers, you know, lands. And I ended up talking with one of them, and he was asking me, he's like, hey, you know, how come, he's like, you like it out here. He's like, you find it enjoyable enough to drive out on your vacations and, you know, sometimes drag my kids along with me. So, but he's like, you know, would you ever move out here? And I was like, well, yeah, but I don't know if I'd ever be able to work out here, at least make the same kind of living doing what I'm doing. And I think that's the big crux of it. Regret, I can't. They love it out there, and I see why. I mean, there's a certain richness of being out there in that area in those small towns, and I think that's why a lot of people stay, even though it's hard. I mean, you talk to some of these people, and it's not an easy go when you got to do a 50-mile-an-hour or 50-mile drive to get to the nearest grocery store because all the grocery stores that were in town closed down because they just couldn't stay in business. It's definitely not easy, but, you know, they like it out there. I will say one of the things that I hear a lot that you'll always think is a stereotype is the younger kids that are left out there, the teenagers or the early 20s that talk about getting away from town as soon as they can. And, you know, as much as it is a stereotype, I've heard it so many times that, you know, you can't dismiss it. It's true that many of the younger people out there just, they want to get out. And when they hear that I'm like, oh, you're from Chicago, like, I can get just about any teenager talking to me, which is way different than, you know, when I'm in the situation here in the city. They don't want to talk to somebody who's in their 40s, but out there, like, I'm super interesting.
Why is it important to you to document things like the farms, maybe the old movie theater, the old motel? Why do you want to capture these?
You know, to me, there's this sense of this a generation. I mean, America was built on agriculture. You could say it was, you know, built on, you know, the railroads or steel or all this other stuff. But way before that, 90% of this country were farmers. And our great land and the abundance of the soil here helped really raise this country up. And, you know, when you look at other great civilizations. You know, I would like to think that America in the record books is, you know, in the next 1,000 years will be looked at one of those. We don't have the ruins of, you know, say like the pyramids or the Great Walls. None of that stuff is going to be around here. And I think that's the farmland that's out there, these barns and this kind of way of life, this golden age of farming. And, you know, they have great big silos now and grain elevators and everything's modern and it's very efficient. But there's something about the imagery of this kind of golden age. I'm not necessarily trying to say that it needs to be saved or cultivated anyway. One of the things I always say about this is I'm not trying to preserve this or fight against, you know, big agriculture and like, you know, major farms, but it's just to document it there on its way out, you know, because I definitely couldn't document it while it was thriving. Obviously, I'm not that old, but, you know, to just keep it there and to have this visual record of what it looked like at the end before it is all gone, because there's so many places I go back to now, some of my favorite places, and they're not the same. Buildings are gone, barns gone, sometimes whole blocks are just missing now.
Briefly, Vincent, we're just about out of time, but you were in sure. Wisconsin, I think, last year. Leave us with a couple of memories or impressions you had in our state.
You know, you got a beautiful state there. I had my college roommate at Columbia was from Sun Prairie, so I had ended up there a few times, you know, back in college. But, you know, I was in the southern part the last time I was there, and I will say I ended up around the Mineral Point area was where I kind of ended. And Mineral Point's somewhat of a touristy destination, but, you know, even there, you know, there's some vacant storefronts. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you could rediscover yourself outside of farming, I think that's a way to preserve some of these rural areas. But for the most part, a lot of these small towns that you see in your state, in, you know, all across America, they're going away. And so, you know, get off the highway, drive out there and see them, you know.
Vincent, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Rob, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Vincent Johnson is a Chicago-based photojournalist, filmmaker, and founder of the Lost Americana Documentary Project. He joined us to talk about his work traveling around the country documenting rural communities through photography. You can see his blog and some of his work at lostamericana.com. This week, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced that the Trump administration is earmarking $12 billion in aid to agricultural producers who are caught in the middle of current trade conflicts, tariffs, and counter-tariffs. The first stage is expected to roll out in September and involves direct payments to some agricultural producers. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at the UW-Madison. He specializes in international trade agreements. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, there's a lot of trade news going on, as there always seems to be, but let's start with this $12 billion package trying to kind of compensate some producers affected by retaliatory tariffs.
Yeah, so the Canadians, the Europeans, the Chinese, in response to the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs, have put in place a variety of retaliatory tariffs, some including agricultural goods, soybeans, pork in particular. And so this is an aid package to farmers that have been hit by the adverse consequences of the Trump administration's tariffs and the retaliation of other trading partners.
Have we seen an aid package like this before for people affected by tariffs?
It's sort of strange because usually what happens is you see compensation to the material losers from trade policy, but this is compensation for people who have been hit not by other countries' trade policies, but by other countries' responses to our own trade policies. So there's a sort of, you know, the administration giving with one hand and taking away. You know, these policies, the damage inflicted on farmers is really from the U.S. government's own policy choices. So it's sort of offsetting something that was already put in place by the Trump administration.
The argument from the Trump administration is that, okay, yes, we know this, if these tariffs went on forever, this would be kind of a drop in the bucket, but they're not gonna. We're going to be negotiating. We're taking a tough line now. This is to get people through in the interim until we get a better tariff situation.
Possibly, although it's sort of, yeah, that's the hard thing to figure out right now, which is what is the medium or long-term strategy. So that's the rhetoric is we're doing these things. There may be some short-term pain for certain sectors and certain people in the country. But in the long term, we're going to get to some set of better deals, market access, other countries changing their policies. That's not clear yet. And it's not entirely clear, at least to me, what exactly the Trump administration sees as the longer term outcome.
I want to give a listen to the voices of a few regional farmers talking about this package.
That $12 billion is just a drop in the bucket for the damage that this is being caused. I got a neighbor that has lost $60,000 on soybeans sitting in his grain bins in the last 2 months because of the price drops and these tariffs. If the government really wants to help farmers, they need to work on opening up more markets, supporting small farmers by breaking up agribusiness conglomerates and putting more money towards ag research.
This bailout subsidies, or whatever you want to call it, is just like any other farm program where any money that's in the pot is going to go to the largest corporate ag industry, farmers, whatever you want to call them, you can think of. The small guy, they're not going to get nothing.
That's just kind of a Band-Aid. It's something to help us get through, but we still need the markets to be able to move our product worldwide.
So a couple of our callers, Aaron, a farmer in Peshtigo, Taylor, a farmer in Rushford, Minnesota, and Kevin Semke, a corn and soybean farmer in the town of Hamburg, thanks to WXOW in La Crosse for that third clip. Is this the kind of reaction we're hearing from the farming community?
I think so. I mean, I had, there's another quote that I saw today in the Minnesota Star Tribune about this is a Band-Aid on an arterial bleed, but I think this is the response you're hearing. American agricultural exporters are overwhelmingly dependent on export markets. And so sort of $12 billion sounds like a lot of money until you think of soybeans and pork in the magnitude of trade in the global economy and American agricultural exports. Soybean prices have cratered. China says they're going to start importing, all of their soybeans from Brazil instead of the United States. Pork exports to China have basically cratered and collapsed as well. And so it's a tiny amount of money, and it seems like a one-time payment. It's not going to sort of serve the long-term economic interests of farmers. The other thing that was touched on in those quotes is, the U.S., like the European Union, like Canada, like Japan, spends billions, tens of billions of dollars on agricultural subsidies, but they overwhelmingly go, the vast majority of that, I think 70 or 80%, goes to the largest farmers, right? Agribusiness firms. So, when you're talking about small farms, that $12 billion, how much of that is actually going to go to individual family farms? It's going to be a very small amount of money.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, looking at tariffs, an aid package for American farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs, and this new deal or agreement to try to reach a deal between the U.S. now and the European Union. What do we know about that?
So the EU is one of the countries or groups, the European Union group of 28 countries, has put in place retaliatory tariffs for the steel and aluminum tariffs. And Jean-Claude Juncker, who is the president of the European Commission, came to have discussions with Trump yesterday. And the statement that they agreed on was we're going to sort of back off and maybe cool down the rhetoric a little bit and start to engage in talks to back down from the various tariffs that have been in place. The other thing the Trump administration has talked about was an across-the-board auto tariff, right, on the EU. And so this was the big thing that prompted Juncker's visit. And they put out a statement or a communique that basically said we're going to work now towards zero tariffs and getting rid of trade barriers and investment barriers in the medium term. Now we're going to talk about whether or not the steel and aluminum tariffs are going to stay in place. And then there were a couple lines in this public announcement about things like the Europeans buying more liquefied natural gas, buying more soybeans. It's not clear whether they can really do those things, whether the European Commission can order individual European countries in the EU to start buying those products. But I think the bigger picture thing actually is, if you read that communique in the whole, it sounds very much like a transatlantic trade agreement between the U.S. and the EU, which it was in negotiations for 4 years in the Obama administration from 2013 to 2017 to remove about 97% of the tariff barriers between the EU and the U.S. And just like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we've spoken about previously, that was one of the things that the Trump administration immediately, when Trump came into office, suspended and said, we're not pursuing that anymore. So it's sort of interesting to think about at this point, after all of these tariffs and retaliatory tariffs and saber-rattling about trade wars, that maybe what's going to happen is we're sort of going back to the status quo of January 2017.
I want to talk about the relative fairness of the tariff situation, say, between the United States and the European Union. The president points toward high tariffs on American-built cars going to Europe, not matched by tariffs, at least on all vehicles coming from the EU. It's different for, I think, pickup trucks or something like that.
Yeah.
He's talked about the tariffs from Canada on dairy. But there are American agricultural tariffs. I was looking at sugar. There's a fairly protectionist tariff protecting the American sugar industry. When you sort it all out, and I know this is a big, complicated picture, are we on a par? Are we more lax with tariffs than other countries? How does it all stack up?
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of the things I think about a lot, which is the fundamental starting point for Trump's trade policies is basically an assertion of a reality that doesn't really exist, which is, you know, all the other countries are sort of cheating and getting by with lots of tariffs and lots of trade barriers. And that's what's causing our massive trade deficit. And we sort of have open markets. And why are we letting everybody else get away with it? The Canadians, the Americans, the Japanese, the European Union, all industrialized countries subsidize agriculture. It, you know, is sort of an industry we're relatively less competitive in global markets. There's cultural reasons for it. Tens of billions of dollars of subsidies. The EU spends $50 billion on the common agricultural policy to do this. And industrial tariffs and non-tariff barriers across the Atlantic, basically roughly the same levels, right? They vary by sector, right, depending on what is politically sensitive. But the overall tariff rates, the average tariff rates for the U.S. on European goods and for the EU on American goods, very close, right? And so the underlying sources of our trade deficits have to do with a lot of other things: relative economic growth, the standing of the dollar in the global economy, international capital flows, which are the mere image of flows in goods and services. And so Trump connects all of those things together in a very zero sum, right? We are losing, everybody else is winning because look at our trade deficit. But it's really not about trade policy, right? And the other thing we've talked a lot about previously is about the globalization of value chains, right? So there are multinational corporations that are doing business across Canada, Mexico, the United States, and the EU. And these tariffs and retaliatory tariffs, the main effect they're having is actually raising the costs of inputs of production for American corporations.
We're talking to Mark Koplovich right now, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. He specializes in international trade agreements. We're looking at, among other things, the $12 billion in aid to farmers being affected by trade wars and tariffs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this aid package for farmers hit by retaliatory tariffs? Good idea? Or would you rather see the tough talk and tariffs be scaled back? If you're a farmer, tell us if you're feeling the impact of these tariffs and what you want. Do you want this aid package? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the escalating trade disputes between the U.S. and its main trading partners and whether the $12 billion in aid that the Trump administration is putting in place is what U.S. farmers need. Mark Koplovich is with us, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea of providing farmers with this federal aid to get through this, at least short-term, back-and-forth tariff battle? Do you think the Trump administration's tough stance will ultimately help the United States, or are you worried about the impact of these tariffs and whether they're going to escalate? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A couple comments from Facebook. Tyrone says, Trump's misguided trade war is harming American farmers, so he's asking for $12 billion in relief. Trump's trade policies are equivalent to pushing unsuspecting people into a hole and then acting like a hero when you offer them a ladder. We also heard from Ellen, who says, it's misguided to blame farmers. They did not ask for trade wars. Blame Trump. Okay, now let's talk about overproduction of goods. Let's go to your calls now. Bart is with us in Madison. Bart, hi.
Hello. Yeah, thank you. I was just curious if the farmer bailout seems to be kind of created the need for this. And is Donald Trump personally making money from this?
Bart, thanks for the call. I'm not sure if the Trump organization has a lot in agriculture.
Not that I'm aware of. I do think that, as I said, this is $12 billion, but it is not going to be evenly distributed amongst, you know, all farmers, because there are, you know, large firms in certain farming sectors that control 60, 70, 80% of the market. So the benefits are not going to be spread out to small family farms. They're going to be heavily concentrated more in industrial agribusiness. But I'm not aware of any direct links, no.
Bart, thanks for the call. I want to get into kind of a flip side of tariffs and the advantage, relative advantage of high or low tariffs. We've talked about this a little before, Mark. With Canada, they've got this production plan that they protect their dairy industry up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like Canadians pay a little bit more, consumers pay a little bit more to buy dairy products. Is there an argument to be made that, okay, maybe this tariff protects people in one industry, but it's hurting generally consumers around the country by driving up costs?
Well, I mean, that's the basic trade-off with protectionism, right? Is, you know, free trade lowers the costs of goods, it increases quantity and also variety in many cases, and so consumers benefit from free trade, but import competing firms are harmed. So the Canadians are subsidizing dairy, but we also subsidize sugar, as you said, and other agricultural products. What that means is when you and I go into the supermarket, that we're paying a little bit more for a gallon of milk or anything that has sugar or soy in it, depending on the subsidies we're talking about. But we don't notice, right, or we sort of don't mobilize politically. The angry milk consumers of America are not lobbying the government for free trade. But you do have organized trade associations from farmers and steel producers that are pressing for trade protection. And again, that's, as we said before, the U.S. does this, the EU does this, the Canadians do this. And what has happened over the last 70 years with trade policies at the domestic and international level is move to closer and closer free trade. You know, tariffs used to be very, very high. They're in the single digits on most things now. But you never really get to perfectly free trade because of the political pressure for some subsidies and protection.
I've talked to people about trade issues in the past who have said, yeah, we did need kind of a trade subsidy for certain sectors of the United States, not because of things like retaliatory tariffs, but for people whose jobs were disrupted by free trade agreements. There are people in some industries who lose out. We should have had, they say, these kind of multi-billion dollar subsidies then to help smooth the road for free trade.
Yeah, and this is the political debate we never have and most countries never really have, which is you're not going to get the benefits of free trade in terms of growth and aggregate welfare and lower prices for consumers without some people losing their jobs in some sectors. And we could have a political discussion about the government investing in policies and programs that might help, right, you know, offset the hit to people who have lost their jobs, retraining, moving them into other sectors, direct cash payments. But those are politically sensitive topics that we never get to. We do, right, and I think, again, this has to do with political organization and, you know, actors mobilizing and pressuring the government. We do give payments for the subsidies and for the trade protection, and that has to do with collective action and, you know, campaign contributions and which actors are able to access politicians. But we, you know, the U.S., like the Europeans, like the Canadians, doesn't have a large-scale worker retraining or a trade compensation fund that gets allocated to people who are materially hit by free trade.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Ken, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing? I just wanted to say or take issue with that tweet, or I think it was a Facebook comment that you read that said that, you know, that the farmers didn't want this and they didn't ask for this. And I was going to say that they really did ask for this because the majority of rural voters voted for Trump. And this is exactly what he promised. He said, we are going to renegotiate these trade deals because we're getting ripped off. And that this is what renegotiation looks like. So I really don't have a lot of sympathy, you know, for people that are getting bit by something that they voted for.
Ken, thanks for the call. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge debate in political science about what drove people to support Trump, and more broadly, why do people vote for political candidates against their material interest, right? And so why you support Trump or another presidential candidate is a multidimensional thing. It could do with identity. It could do with race. It could do with religion. It could do with social issues. It could also do with your material interests based on what your job or sector of employment is. So there's lots of reasons why people supported Trump and might have voted for him, even though he talked about these policies coming down the pike. But the other thing is he talked about a ton of policies during the campaign. And so it was hard to nail down, I think, which policies was he serious about? Which policies was he throwing out there because he thought they were politically popular? Which policies were simply rhetoric and throwaway lines? It's hard to tell in a presidential campaign, you know, what are the actual policy outputs of a president going to be in the first year or two of his administration? And so I think a lot of people, you know, voted for him for other reasons or in spite of these policies maybe having some sort of material impact on them. But I think a lot of people also said, who knows what's going to come out. There are other reasons why I like him, and I don't know if the tariffs are actually going to play out.
I want to spend our last minute or two on something you touched on earlier, kind of the unique nature of agriculture. A lot of countries want to preserve domestic agricultural production for a variety of reasons, strategic reasons. You want to produce your own food. Right. So we get these subsidies, sometimes tariffs, but then we end up in a world awash with subsidized food and then prices being driven down, putting farmers out of business in a lot of places. It's a special industry in some ways.
It's the oldest argument for trade protection. And if you go back to Adam Smith and David Ricardo writing in the 18th and 19th century of the arguments about comparative advantage and why free trade was a good thing, the oldest counter argument to that is national security, right? If we're fighting wars, if Britain and France are fighting wars together, the British can't be dependent on the French for food. But there are also cultural reasons, right? The common agricultural policy in the EU was something the French lobbied very hard for, right, in the sort of 1950s, 60s, and 70s, because farming is part of the sort of French identity. And the other thing to think about is advanced industrialized countries have a comparative advantage in global markets in goods that are capital intensive, services, financial services, things like that. So global competition, free trade and agriculture would be competing against developing countries that actually have a comparative advantage in those goods. So there's a broader development aspect of it, too. There are effects of agricultural subsidies here at home, but agricultural subsidies also hurt developing countries because that's their primary exports. And those subsidies are actually leading to overproduction and are keeping their goods out of the advanced industrialized world.
We'll leave it there for now. I'm sure we'll be talking about this more in the future. Mark, thanks for coming up.
Thanks again.
I've been talking to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us to talk about the $12 billion in aid that the Trump administration is putting in place to support farmers affected by ongoing trade disputes, plus wider issues in the ongoing back and forth on international trade and tariffs. You can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the latest in tariffs, a potential deal to negotiate more with the European Union, this aid for farmers? Let us know what you think on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, today is the court-ordered deadline for the federal government to reunite parents and children separated at the border. A reporter gives us the latest on that story. We'll find out what it's like for Wisconsin businesses trying to hire employees in a tight job market. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, it's cool food with great presentation. Our guest gives us ideas for food trays, boards, and maybe you can share your favorite relish platter, too. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.